Blog Talk Radio.
Show. I told you last night, if you were listening, and if you weren't paying attention, you have to stand in the corner with your pants down, that we were going to cover drugs. It's the number one chapter in my book. It's entitled Drugs Suck, and it's the takedown of America. And it's got international implications. And I referred to a book that Jimmy from Brooklyn recommended entitled Red Cocaine. And I went out and got the book, and it's out of print, so I had to buy one used, and they're a collector's item. I would say the book is at least 10 years old, and I paid 55 kishmolis for it. So I'm going to share that book with you tonight, because just in case you never find it. But I'm going to open with the chapter one in my book, which is the most important chapter in my entire book, The Greatest Threat to America is chapter one, and that's drugs. And I want you to think about something. Every time you see a gate on a store, every time you see a burglar alarm in a house or a window, it was all brought here by drugs. And somebody sent me a 1910 a rundown on how much things cost. And in 1910, did you know gasoline was sold in drugstores? And there was only 140 miles of paved road. But the thing that blew my mind was heroin, cocaine, and marijuana were all sold in drugstores. And Las Vegas, Nevada had a population of 30 people. But drugs has been the downfall of America since the late 50s, early 60s. And I know, because I seen it take over Manhattan. We went from a nation of drunkies to a nation of junkies. It is really sad. And in my chapter one, I play Huey Lewis in the News. It's Hip to Be Square. And I have a picture of a Marine saluting the American flag, and he's missing his hand. He's got a sock over his arm. And underneath I write, "In wartime, many brave men die. They wanted to live more than anyone. For them, we have monuments and hallowed grounds and walls. At any given time, there are people who have everything to live for, yet they choose to impose self-inflicted wounds, which eventually lead to death. The morgues are full of junkies who thought weed leads nowhere, and they can handle the strain. They also die where they fall. Usually for junkies, it's in the bathroom." And if you want to see the scourge of drugs, go to an emergency room late Friday night, early Saturday morning, and see what they're wheeling in. Those who need a fix and can't get it, those who ran out of drugs. And it seems like America doesn't make anything anymore but the sinful industry. And as a result, we have rehab units where there never was. They used to call them sanatoriums for guys that wanted to dry out. But they weren't on every street like an abortion clinic, which is also related to drugs. So on my page 12 in my book, I've got the Tomb of the Unknown Junkie. And it's a toilet full of marijuana plants and candles all around the bowl. And it says, "Please do not smoke the perpetual care plant." If you wipe out drugs, you immediately wipe out 80% of all crimes committed in the USA. So where is the will to win? Hey, Snortface, remember me when you do terrorist drugs. Then I tell a story about an agent, drug enforcement agent who was kidnapped in Guadalajara, Mexico, and killed by drug traffickers. And you see what's going down in Mexico now. 28,000 dead Mexicans last year, all because of drugs. You've got drug lords that are fighting to take over the government. Which brings me to Jimmy's book, Jimmy's recommended book, and that's Red Cocaine. And there's an introduction by a guy named Dr. Ray Klein. And so I'm going to read you the introduction for Red Cocaine, and if I start to bore you and I sense it, I'll break to a happy tune. And maybe I'll go to Cab Calloway singing Kicking the Gong Around. That's an opium song. This book will come as a shock to most people. Now, this is Red Cocaine. For many years, the conventional wisdom has been that the drug problem is strictly of our own making. Without our demand, there would be no supply. Drug traffickers are only in it for profit. Furthermore, as a high-level State Department official assured Congress in 1985, there is no evidence of a drug conspiracy to weaken the American social fabric by promoting the use of drugs. Remember, the title of this book is Red Cocaine. Hang in there, I got a sip. Get that parchment out of my throat. Red Cocaine presents unpleasant facts contradicting these views. Dr. Joseph Douglas, the author of this book, is not selling a theory, but instead calling attention to evidence. He has marshaled his facts carefully, presents them responsibly and cautiously, and offers a wealth of soberly documented data. This book's got a ton of footnotes. That data describes in detail the efforts of China, the Soviet Union, and by the way, both China and the Soviet Union on the same day unveiled their stealth of fighter jets, or bombers, and a week after Obama promised to give all our nukes to Russia. And Jimmy from Brooklyn says, "The Russians are playing chess and we're playing checkers. Everybody thinks that communism died when the wall came down. They just changed strategy. And it looks like they scrapped their entire military and are rebuilding a new and more superior one." And the proof of the pudding will be the day we're all standing in rubble asking what happened. So, let me go back. That data describes in detail the efforts of China, the Soviet Union, and its many surrogates to use drugs over many decades as weapons designed to damage and weaken, if not destroy, the stability of free world countries. And you know, I've seen pictures of guys in Afghanistan, you know, where they grow the poppies, and in Pakistan, and you know how they take their drugs? They slice their arms and they put it right in the bloodstream. The top target is and always has been, of course, the United States. Why? Because the United States has money. And the United States has dopey kids on dope. Nobody would suggest that the entire drug problem is a result of a communist plot. There is some truth in the conventional wisdom about our own responsibilities. Yeah, I don't believe in blaming Mexicans and Colombians for the drug problem. It's Junior. Chain him in the basement. What you will find in this book, however, is a powerful and well-documented case of a deliberate policy decision, first by authorities in Beijing and then in Moscow. It's funny, isn't it, that the Chinese won't allow a freedom of religion, but they make all the creches that come into the United States? Yeah, or a lot of them anyway, right? Everything is made in China today. Even the rope they're going to hang us with. They're not even going to hang us with our own rope. To contribute to the decay of American society, this case cries out for close and serious inspection by ordinary citizens. My friends, the only people that are left that can help this country are ordinary citizens. Your politicians won't do it. They're all bought and paid for. Don't believe what they tell you. They're lying through their teeth. When you're not looking, they'll vote against you. And when you're looking, they'll have an excuse why they can't vote. As well as at the very highest levels in the U.S. government. Yes. And if you want to know, you want a prime example that smacks you right in the face? Hillary Rodham Clinton's brother, Bill, brought $450,000 in Vignali drug money to the Clinton house, and was told that he had to give it back because they all got caught. Yeah, you know the difference between a Democrat and a Republican? When a Republican gets caught taking drug money, they say, "I didn't do it." And when a Democrat gets caught taking drug bribes, they say, "You can't prove it." This case cries out for close and serious inspection. And we're looking at the highest levels of U.S. government. What is history must be reckoned with in predicting the future. That's important. What is history must be reckoned with in predicting the future. Americans deserve full and frank examination of just how deeply Moscow and Beijing, and these two guys pretended they were enemies to catch the U.S. off guard. That's according to Jimmy from Brooklyn. But Jimmy from Brooklyn says that when the communists win, they win, and when they lose, they win. So they've been playing good guy and bad guy, but they're both on the same team. And tonight, there's a guy is out saying that Budo, the woman who ran for office, was delivering Pakistan nuclear secrets to the North Koreans when shopping for a coat with deep pockets. Yep. And you know who's sitting on those nukes in Pakistan? Al-Qaeda. It's just a question of when they take over the headquarters. So Moscow and Beijing have been involved in creating and masterminding the worldwide drug crisis. Nothing moves people to treachery more than money. Money is the root of all evil, like that man said. This book offers persuasive evidence that the communist role was large, very large. This book shows, with a wealth of documentation, that command and control of the worldwide drug network emanated from the very top leadership levels of the communist dictatorships. At the very minimum, the U.S. government ought to provide a full accounting of red cocaine's thesis that much of today's drug scourge is a direct result of coordinated and cynical Soviet bloc and Chinese intelligence operations around the world, especially in the Western Hemisphere. And those Soviet bloc and Chinese intelligence operations exist very stronger today than ever before. If you don't believe me, ask the Pentagon how come they couldn't download their computers for 3 hours. And now you got a guy found in a dumpster, and they're reporting tonight that some Philadelphia cop believes he climbed in the dumpster and died. Did you see the dumpsters that they showed on Fox? The dumpsters are over your head. It would, this guy supposedly weighed 200 pounds. He was 6 foot. You're not going to... He couldn't even climb in. In the condition he was in, he couldn't climb in that dumpster. He couldn't even put his shoe on. And they're saying that he climbed in and died in the dumpster. Are you kidding me? It would take 3 grown men of equal weight and height to put that guy in the dumpster. Dead weight. So, if we are serious about winning this war on drugs, we must know, too, and I often wonder, is there one city, one town left in the United States that's drug-free? And if they are, they should have a big sign at the border saying, "Welcome to drug-free so-and-so." When I see Amish kids buying drugs in malls, I know that the country is completely finished. If we are serious about winning this war on drugs, we must know, too, to what extent it is true, as this book argues. The top officials in Washington have had access to the evidence for many years, but preferred to hush it up out of concern for what public disclosure would do to U.S. Sino-Soviet relations. Yeah, I wonder if they're going to smoke the missiles that Obama's giving them. I wonder if he's going to give them those missiles to even out the level the playing field. Clearly, the war on drugs cannot be won unless we know how and where the problem began. Unless we know who and where our enemies in that war are, even as many, got to turn the page, communist states are crumbling and experiencing extraordinary changes, we need to know how this drug genie got out of the bottle and how we can get it back under control. I'm going to take a break. I have a phone ringing. Hang in there. I'm back. Those of us who have spent the better part of our lives in the intelligence profession are, alas, all too familiar with how and why this can and does happen. It happens because the fact-finding and analysis process is subordinated to supposedly larger geopolitical or strategic considerations determined at the policy level. In the process, the information passed on to our nation's leaders is often brushed aside. The man who was the principal source of information for red cocaine was, in a very real sense, a victim of bad timing. His name is Jan Sejnak. And he chose to defect from his native Czechoslovakia, where he occupied a high and crucial post in 1968. He could not have picked a worse time. In 1968, official Washington, weary of the Cold War and on the end of losing a shooting war in Vietnam, was on a threshold of a new era of detente. So it was that this man, Sejina, who brought with him unprecedented knowledge of many of the communist world's deepest and darkest secrets, was about to become, to his American host, not a hero to be lionized, but an embarrassment to be hidden away. What he knew, what might in an earlier era have become widely known and acted on, became instead a casualty of the yearning for detente. Data that does not support the politically desired or fashionable goal of managing detente between Moscow and Washington has a hard time, a very hard time, surfacing or being heard. Needless to say, throughout the intelligence community, scores of conscientious officers fight against this pernicious process, often to the extent of putting their jobs, reputations, and very careers on the line. We got a guy doing time in jail in Leavenworth right now because he asked the president to produce his birth certificate. And he was charged with a military crime. But their efforts are more than that, a quixotic struggle. Simplistic grand strategies will often prevail when facts cannot. Experts whose experience predates President Nixon and President Carter's playing the China card, that stunning initiative to court the previously quarantined Beijing regime, has long been well aware of Chinese drug trafficking. Later we learned as well of Soviet ties to international guerrilla and terrorist organization and the trading of guns for drugs and vice versa. Many of us suspected that there was a connection of some sort between increased drug trafficking and the Soviet Union, which the Soviet Union exists to this very day, and Putin runs it. Especially given the various bits between increased drug trafficking and the Soviet Union. Especially given the various bits and pieces of intelligence on the drug trafficking activities of its many surrogate client states. Our suspicions rested on the very sound proposition that those surrogates were too tightly tied to Moscow for the Kremlin to be unaware of what they were doing. Perhaps Moscow did not direct and control the international drug business, but they must have been aware of it and allowed it to spread. There's a guy in an American jail right now. His name is Victor Batz. Victor Batz is an arms dealer and a Soviet playboy, believed to be KGB, and he has delivered arms even for our own government, allegedly. And he's in jail very quietly. I guess they're waiting for him to get cancer. But one day his story will come out, and we'll all learn it because I don't know it. But you know who does? Jimmy from Brooklyn. He's probably underground now, Jimmy from Brooklyn. He's probably down there with Lex Luthor in the sewers of New York. Our awareness and suspicions, but he doesn't want to be put in a dumpster like the guy in Delaware. Our awareness and suspicions turned to shock as we watched drug trafficking and international terrorism become home page news. And you know, you've seen pictures of all these drug raids and the millions and millions of dollars that fill up rooms. And you know, when you've got that kind of money, you've got a lot of slaves. You've got people that will kill for that money gladly. Wild detente still seemed to matter more than the unpleasant facts about drugs. Let me see what we got here. This is still the introduction. We're almost finished. We've got a page to go, page and a half. It was into this political swamp that John Cigena leaped. Understanding the reluctance at the policy level to face disagreeable information helps one to understand why the reception he got from Washington's intelligence community. I don't have much faith in Washington's intelligence community. When the CIA walks around for 8 years asking, when is Bush going to get bin Laden, I know we're in trouble. When a George Tenet wears a pink tie and cries at graduation time, and he didn't know, everybody knew bin Laden was coming, but they didn't know how. Come on. Give me a break. Washington's intelligence community, as detailed in Chapter 10 of this book, was considerably less than warm. Understanding this also puts into perspective the rumors propagated about him by both the intelligence and policy community, as well as by our principal strategic adversary, the Soviet Union. One can only suppose that it is a tribute, and the Soviet Union is still the Soviet Union, when Putin can reach out into a London a luncheonette and poison a guy having a cup of tea. You know the Soviet Union is the good old Soviet, the same ones that killed the Leon Trotsky in Mexico. One can only suppose that it is a tribute to the importance of what he does know, that those aimed at discrediting him persist to this present day. I was posted in Germany as intelligence advisor to the U.S. Embassy in Bonn at the time General Sugina defected. Hence, I have no first-hand knowledge of or connection with the decisions made at that time. I have noted over the years the various rumors and have watched with interest as his testimony, far from being discredited, had been confirmed or otherwise proven correct again and again. I am, for example, personally aware of the authenticity of what he had to say on the subjects of the Soviet connection with international terrorism, their training of terrorists, and the signal importance of the Soviet Defense Council in Soviet decision-making. It was then a pleasant surprise for me when Dr. Douglas arrived in my office one morning and asked if I'd be willing to take a critical look at his manuscript. So I read Red Cocaine with great care. I came away impressed. I was impressed with how professionally and objectively Dr. Douglas had assembled and presented his arguments. I came away impressed with how he had strengthened the value of the text through abundant and informative endnotes, representing a whole added dimension of data supporting the basic thesis. At the same time, as he said he would do in the preface, Dr. Douglas concentrates on giving the general non-professional reader a coherent story that enough information to present a clear picture without unduly burdening him with technical detail. In other words, he's keeping it sweet and simple. As befits an analysis of this nature, the best approach is to let the facts speak for themselves. Understating, if anything, the argument, Dr. Douglas has succeeded admirably. The source material is well developed and, in my opinion, makes plain that Sugina is an excellent source who for many years has remained underexploited. As a longtime intelligence professional, I regret that so much of the inner workings or non-workings of the intelligence community needed to be examined in public. And so this guy is back there in time telling you we got a sucky intelligence community. But I believe the facts must be confronted. That officials, even to this day and age, are still reluctant to face what the Soviet Union was doing in the 60s and 70s. All I know is a lot of guys came back from Nam and they were all potheads. They were defeated on many planes. The object of this exercise, and Hollywood sold pot in Vietnamese movies with guys blowing weed smoke down the barrel of a rifle. Yes, and all they did was take down the American soldier. And the American soldier didn't get his pride back until we went to liberate Kuwait. That's how long they've been carrying those crutches around. To those who would say, given the cataclysmic upheavals of 1989 in the Soviet bloc, this is all ancient history, as a word to the wise, I would respond, not so fast, do not be so sure. Whatever the ultimate outcome of these upheavals, the fact remains that they have not reduced the military capability of the Soviet armed forces, but have actually improved and modernized the vast array of Soviet strategic intercontinental weapons that they will not show to President Schmuck, who just assigned away our self-defense capability, along with 67 senators, and at least 17 of them were repuppies. And I'd say get the repuppies first, and then we can fight the Democrats. Get rid of the repuppies first. Not so fast, and do not be so sure. Okay. They have not yet diminished the levels of military assistance provided by Moscow to countries like Cuba, North Korea, and Angola. Nor have they decreased the Soviet bloc intelligence activities around the world. Furthermore, however, and kindly we might be inclined to feel today about the new Soviet state, the fact that we cannot begin to mount a truly effective attack on drugs, and here in this country they want to legalize it. And if you think they're going to just stop at marijuana, you're crazy. you need to go to Needle Park in Amsterdam and fall on your sword. Nor have they decreased the Soviet bloc intelligence activities around the world. Furthermore, however kindly we might be inclined to feel today that the new Soviet state, the fact that we cannot begin to mount a truly effective attack on drugs, we can't. I remember in the 60s cops telling me that busting people for marijuana was a waste of time. So the cops lost the war in the 60s. Much less win the war, and you know why? Because they didn't want to arrest their own sons and daughters. Much less win the war without understanding everything there is to be known about the origins and growth of the vast narcotics empire. You've seen the money that's in here. It corrupts bankers, politicians, governments. It corrupts whole governments. Look at poor Mexico. In that sense alone, look at Colombia and all of the suffering and anguish. In that sense alone, what Jan Sugina has to tell us in the pages of this book turns out to be of vital concern to all of us. The drug problem has become a national disgrace and a significant threat to our national security. 1 out of 5 Americans is a junkie, my friend. They are hiding that number from you. Do your own research. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. I'm sure you know of a family who has a family member that's got a drug problem. I know people who have watched their son go off and on for 30 years. It's like a weather check. How is he this week? He's back on it. And he makes good money. He makes big money. I know of young nurses who just graduated the nursing school who went on a vacation to California, a group of 5, and their father, who was a doctor, followed them out to California with a suitcase full of, Demerol. And when the Demerol ran out, he couldn't get any more. And he had to put himself in rehab. And the 5 girls who had studied hard for 4 years in nursing school and looked forward to this vacation had to give it up to give him round-the-clock nursing free. Okay? So when I say one junkie brings down 5 innocent people, I'm not far off. And you look in your own family, if you got a junkie in the family, he's taken down at least 5 innocent people. He's broken at least 5 hearts. I say he, there, she's too. The drug problem has become a national disgrace and a significant threat to our national security. But it's big money. That's why California, who's $500 billion in the hole, wants to legalize marijuana so they can charge people after they're hooked and take the VIG. What's the difference between the pusher and the tax collector? They both have the same objective, make money on the addict. I'll say it again, the drug problem has become a national disgrace and a significant threat to our national security, as well as to the well-being of our free society. It is also a threat to the security of our friends and allies, to the health and welfare of the nations struggling to become free and self-reliant in the family of modern nations. It is time to open our eyes to all facets of the drug trafficking problem. And here is the red cocaine story, and chapter 1 will begin after a tune. So hang in there. And wherever we finish up tonight, chapter 2 will follow. I got 25 minutes. I'm going to give you, let's see if I can find Kicking the Gong Around. Kicking the Gong Around. This guy, Cab Calloway, goes back to the 30s. In the 30s, opium was a big thing in New York. Opium dens were a big thing in New York. And my uncle used to tell me a story about when the cops wanted to make a big production out of drug bust. They would bring in one poor drugged Chinese guy who had a coke habit, and the chief of detectives in his desk drawer would have opium pipes and different paraphernalia, and he would set it all up, and they put this poor Chinese guy there, and they would call in the press, and they would announce a $1 million drug bust. You don't think that happened, right? Yeah, well, never can happen. Happens all the time.
The cookies laid around, some were high and some were mighty low. Counting millions on the floor when a knock came on the door, and there stood old Smokey Joe. He was sweating cold and pale, he was looking for his trail, he was broken, all his junk ran out. As he stood and looked around, nobody made a sound, and then you'd hear old Smokey shout, "Tell me, where is Minnie?
Where is Minnie?
Oh, I want my little Minnie. Has she been here kicking the gong around? If you don't know Minnie,
you don't know.
Gets her pleasure kicking the gong around. Giddy weedle diddy woe, diddy weedle diddy woe, hey!
Yeah!
Giddy diddy bang on, lay lay low, lay lay low, what diddy low? Skippity bip, diddy biddy diddy wop, diddy wop, hey! You just tell her Smokey Joe was here in hot to go, and as he departed,
the curtains parted,
and there was Minnie kicking the gong
cocaine, the Chinese drug offensive. In 1928, Mao Zedong, the Chinese communist leader, instructed one of his trusted subordinates, Tan Chen Lin, to begin cultivating opium on a grand scale. Mao had two objectives: obtaining exchange for needed supplies and drugging the white region, where white was an ideological, not racist, a term that Mao used to refer to his non-communist opposition. Mao's strategy was simple: use drugs to soften a target area. Then, after a captured region had been secured, outlaw the use of all narcotics and impose strict controls to ensure that the poppies remained exclusively an instrument of the state for use against its enemies. Later, Mao would speak of using opium against the Imperials as only a modern phase in the opium wars that began in the 19th century. Opium was a powerful weapon that had been used by the Imperialists against the Chinese and should be used against them in the Second Opium War. It was Mao, explained to Wang Chen in a lecture on his plan for planting opium, chemical warfare by indigenous means, methods. However, the fact that opium had previously been used against the Chinese was only a convenient excuse, not the real reason. Mao first began using opium as a political weapon against his own people, the Chinese, during his drive to establish communism throughout China. His use of opium expanded simply because it proved to be a very effective weapon. As soon as Mao had totally secured mainland China in 1949, opium production was nationalized and trafficking of narcotics targeted against non-communist states became a formal activity of the new communist state, the People's Republic of China. The Chinese trafficking operation expanded rapidly. So this is since 1949. Official targets were Japan, the United States military forces in the Far East, neighboring countries throughout the Far East, and the United States mainland. The primary organizations involved in the early 50s were the Chinese Foreign Ministry, the Trade Ministry, and the Intelligence Service. North Korea was also trafficking narcotics in cooperation with China at this time and was directly connected with the flow of drugs into Japan and into U.S. military bases in the Far East. The domestic narcotics problem in Japan had become serious by 1949. The Criminal Investigation Division of the American Armed Forces in Japan, together with Japanese authorities, began constructing a net across the whole of Japan to determine how the drugs were coming into the country. By 1951, the Japanese had officially identified narcotics illegally entering their country and the sources of trafficking, which were the Chinese and North Korean communists. The trafficking was not limited to opium and heroin, but included hashish, marijuana, cocaine, and dangerous synthetic stimulants such as hyropan and aminobutane drug groups. So these guys are into plastic drugs back then. These particular synthetics were especially dangerous and assessed to have been responsible for serious health problems, which first appeared in Japan in the early 50s. The United States experience was similar to that of Japan. New trafficking was first identified in the late 40s. U.S. narcotics and custom agents set up nets to identify the new sources, and in 1951 began seizing large quantities of heroin at such major U.S. ports as New York, San Francisco, and Seattle. The heroin was determined to have been manufactured in China and the trafficking managed by the Chinese. In concert with the emergence of Chinese international narcotics trafficking in 1949 to 1952, China's opium production increased steadily and reached a plateau of 2,000 to 3,000 tons per year. Gee, America snorts that a week. This production held steady up until 58 to 64, when production increased to roughly 8,000 tons a year as part of the Great Leap Forward. Remember his agricultural plan? The Great Leap Forward. The dates of these increases are important, as will be discussed in Chapter 11. In examining narcotics usage in the United States, there are two abrupt changes in the growth pattern that stand out. The use of narcotics in the United States, listen to this, declined during the 30s and the 40s. Then beginning in 49 to 52, an abrupt upswing took place simultaneously with the launching of China's narcotics trafficking operation. So if you want to be drug-free, you got to go back to the 30s and the 40s. After 1952, narcotics consumption leveled off. Then in the late 50s to early 60s, a second major upswing began. This second abrupt change in the growth pattern coincides almost precisely with the second expansion in the Chinese narcotics operation and with the entrance of the Soviet Union into narcotics trafficking, as will be described later. This correlation is one of the indications that the growth in drug trafficking and drug use within the United States and elsewhere is not a simple natural evolutionary process or a phenomena dominated by user demand. Rather, there are strong sub rosa forces at work, stimulating and extending the consumption. In the case of Chinese trafficking, there is no question that it was an official state activity. Data on the Chinese and North Korean trafficking enterprises were obtained by the Japanese Internal Security, U.S. Army Intelligence, the U.S. Narcotics Bureau, operating with the assistance of undercover Treasury agents, which they no longer have, and by CIA covert assets in China, which they no longer have. The data clearly identified production sources, manufacturing and packaging facilities, trafficking networks, and even management organizations. As will be discussed later, the Chinese narcotics operation was also penetrated and watched by both Soviet intelligence and Czechoslovak intelligence, as were certain Chinese narcotics operations conducted jointly with the communists in Korea, Vietnam, and Japan. China's narcotics operations also have been described by several Chinese officials who later left China and were granted political asylum in other countries. One such official who left in the late 50s described a secret meeting of state officials in 1952 when the Chinese operation was reorganized and a 20-year plan adopted. At this meeting, decisions were made to standardize grades of narcotics, establish promotion regulations, set pricing schedules designed to encourage aggressive marketing, dispatch sales representatives, expand research and production, and reorganize management responsibilities. This information is also confirmed by data collected by Soviet and Czechoslovak intelligence agents, as will be discussed in greater detail in chapters 4 and 6. The organization behind the Chinese narcotics operations were extensive and involved many ministries and agencies from the national down to the local level. These organizations saw the reclamation of lands for production, Ministry of Forestry and Reclamation, cultivation and research to produce better varieties of poppies, Ministry of Agriculture, Development of Opiates, Committee for the Review of Austerity, Management of, you know, this sounds like some of the committees we have. Management of Storage and Preparation for Export, Ministry of Commerce, Management of External Trade Organizations, Ministry of Foreign Trade, Statistical Control and Programming. You can see this is a whole, this is one big major industry, business. It's like a big corporation. Or a small corporation. It's still got the same offices. Marketing, security, and covert operations, Ministry of Public Security. Finance, they had the Ministry of Finance. The trafficking tradecraft included classical smuggling, transportation by shipping companies, both knowingly and unknowingly, use of communist and ethnic Chinese abroad, collaboration with international organized crime syndicates, use of foreign posts of mainland parent entities, abuse of diplomatic privilege, use of normal branded merchandise as a cover, transport by mail and forgery or packaging with misleading trademarks, as will be seen later. Soviet drugs, strategy, and tactics employ quite similar techniques, organizational and management targets and motivations, albeit in the Soviet Leninist style on a greatly magnified scale. Throughout the 50s and the 60s, probably the most important official exercising day-by-day control over China's narcotics operations was, guess who? Chou Enlai. As the chief Soviet ideologist, Mikhail Suslov explained during a major speech on China at a meeting of the Soviet Central Committee in February 1964, Chou Enlai's strategy was to disarm the capitalists with the things they liked to taste, meaning drugs. Professor H. Turnbull was head of the Department of Applied Chemistry at the Royal Military College of Science, Shrivenham, United Kingdom, and an expert on narcotics trafficking and its strategic implications. In 1972, following the publicity focused on the massive use of narcotics against U.S. soldiers in Southeast Asia, the guys that came back with Joneses, they were given those Joneses by the enemy. Trumbull prepared a succinct summary of Chinese narcotics trafficking strategy. Chinese trafficking, he wrote, was directed broadly at the major industrial sectors of the free world. In purely commercial terms, these offer obvious targets, since they provide both large and affluent markets. I get a kick out of all these Hollywood actors that think they're drug-free, their kids are going to be drug-free. When they find out that you're the father of that kid, they're going to take that kid down. They're going to get your money. These leading industrial sectors, Archie Bunker is the best example. These leading industrial sectors were particularly vulnerable and due to the open nature of the underlying society. Carol O'Connor had an adopted son who died in an overdose of drugs. And when he tried to get justice, he was sued by the communists. The production and distribution of drugs, Turnbull emphasized, was a valuable source of national income and a powerful weapon of subversion. He then identified, so the Chinese are fighting us on all different levels, we have no idea. They're fighting us on the drug level, they're fighting us on the destruction of industry level, and they're taking our money and they're buying and building stealth fighter jets. He then identified three basic objectives of Chinese subversive activities employing drugs: to finance subversive activities abroad, to corrupt and weaken the people of a free world, and to destroy the morale of U.S. servicemen fighting in Southeast Asia. He didn't have to do that. Back home, Americans were stabbing those GIs in the back. They destroyed the morale. It was their fellow Americans who turned on them and spit on them and broke the back of the U.S. military with the help of politicians and Hollywood, which is more communist today than ever. And not even in McCarthy's time were there as many communists. They dress them up nicer, that's the only thing. Turnbull's conclusion was almost identical to that reached 20 years earlier by the U.S. Commissioner of Narcotics, Harry Anslinger, and it is equally relevant today. The covert dissemination of opium narcotics, in particular the addictive drug heroin, for commercial and subversive purposes, represents one of the gravest threats to the armed services and societies of a free world. The subversive operation must be recognized as a peculiar form of clandestine chemical warfare. It's the same as biological warfare, in which the victim voluntarily exposes himself to chemical attack. That was chapter one, and we'll take a break for a tune. I got 5 minutes left, and we'll set up chapter two for tomorrow night. Hang in there. There may be trouble ahead.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Before the fiddlers have fled, before they ask us to pay the bill, and while we still have the chance, let's face the music and dance. Soon we'll be without the moon, humming a different tune, and then there may be teardrops to shed. So while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Let's face the music and dance. We'll be right back. about the moon, humming a different tune. And then there may be teardrops to shed. So while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Let's face the music and dance.
I jumped into my book and on page 13, I'm going to read you what I wrote. Every movie and TV event is pushing product. Dope jokes sell products. Rehab has an 85% failure rate. Once a junkie, always a junkie. Save the kids before they do the first one. 7 to 12 years old is your only chance. The rest are dead already. The only way to beat drugs is never do the first one. The drug czar has failed. The first mistake was the title czar. We all know what happened to the czar. When I was growing up in Washington Heights, now the drug center of New York, yuppies came over the George Washington Bridge to buy their social drugs, and the cops picked them out right away. Reverse racial profiling. What's a yuppie doing in a ghetto? When I was growing up, there were only three known junkies in my world: Edgar Allan Poe, Gene Krupa, and Hermann Goering. I saw my first junkie on 137th Street in Amsterdam Avenue. He was waiting in the winter for his pusher to bring his fix, a young Spanish guy neatly dressed in a nice suit. He was sweating on a winter day, and his skin was yellow. He was waiting to get well. Rule number one, you'll never get Colombians to kill their own for American boys and girls who want to experiment. So save that money. Drunkenness is beastly, and I can't stand drunks. I hate the mood swings from laughter to tear to violence to tears to laughter. But I will take a drunk any day over a junkie. Junkies lie, cheat, steal, murder, and recruit new junkies. Modern-day vampires. As for rehab, we pick up the tab. Let them wander in the desert for 40 years. They destroy love and the will to love. They would sell their mothers whom they no longer recognize. You stay soft on drugs, you'll watch your world collapse. I live with drunks and junkies, and drunks live longer, and they occasionally sober up, and at least you can hear them coming with the bangs and with the cans and the bottles banging together. So the guy who scores a Budweiser is safer to live with than a joint passer. The sad thing is that today's drunkies are mixing beer and coke, a death cocktail that kills families. The only thing that stops drugs is you. No program, no border patrols, just little old you. Like the Greeks say, nothing to excess. One man's food is another man's poison. You may be genetically equipped to contain a need for alcohol or drugs, but you may be signing your best friend's death warrant. But if you're a junkie already, that's no big deal. Next time you get high with your so-called friends, think about a young man I know who OD'd on heroin, his first shot of heroin, and while he was dying, his good friends all left him and he nude in the park, and some people say that when the cops arrived, they let him die. Later, he was ID'd by a broken-hearted father at the morgue, so he went from OD to ID. And at the wake, the family was outnumbered by visiting junkies who wanted to check it out in the neighborhood that only a few years before only saw junkies on the silver screen. Today, slavery is bigger than ever before in the USA and its drug slaves. I will talk to you tomorrow, same topic. God bless you and protect you. O'clock, and we're taking a break. Tomorrow when I wake up, I'm taking a shower. And my wife is off. And I'm not touching anything. Thank you, Lord.